for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates admitted the U.S. does not know where Osama bin Laden is. During his address from West Point last week, President Obama called the war in Afghanistan, quote, the epicenter of the violent extremism practiced by al-Qaeda and, quote, a war of necessity. Joining me to talk about the fight against al-Qaeda and last week's terrorist attack in Somalia, Rudy Atalla. He's former Africa Counterterrorism Director with the Secretary of Defense Policy Office, Robert Grenier. He's former director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, and Daniel Byman. He's director of Georgetown University's Center for Peace and Security Studies. We do welcome your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And before we begin the conversation with our guests here in the studio, joining us from Nairobi is New York Times East Africa Bureau Chief Jeffrey Gittleman. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for being with us.
That's good to help.
Tell me what the latest is that you have heard and seen on the terrorist attacks last week in Mogadishu.
Well, it was one of the most serious attacks Somalia has ever seen. A suicide bomber dressed up like a woman came into a medical school graduation and blew himself up. And it looked like it was a very targeted assassination because he went right up to four officials sitting at a podium, and there were four ministers of Somalia's very weak transitional government, and he killed them and about 20 other people. And it's a real blow to this government because they've been trying to establish just a foothold in the capital, which is seething with terrorists and warlords and many people who don't want a stable government in Somalia. And this was supposed to be in a part of the city that was safe, and this attack basically demonstrated that nowhere is safe and no one is safe in Mogadishu.
Was, in fact, al-Shabaab responsible for the attack, or have they still not claimed responsibility?
The Shabaab are denying any connection to this attack, but we're not sure what that really means, because from all the information that I have and others have, the Shabaab are the only ones capable of pulling off a sophisticated suicide bombing like that. There are many militant groups in Somalia. There are many people with guns. There are many axes to grind. But there's really only one group that has the technical know-how and the outside support to do something like this, and that's the Shabaab.
Tell me who or what is Shabaab?
Shabaab is an extremist Islamic group in Somalia that is a mix of Somalis and foreigners. And they have their interpretation of Islam is a very harsh form of it. They have amputated thieves' hands. They have stoned women to death who they have accused of adultery. They have done many things that have really alienated the Somali population. Their goal is to make Somalia a pure Islamic state. And part of that has appealed to jihadists from around the world. So we have people from Chechnya, Afghanistan, Pakistan, even the United States, coming to join the Shabaab because they're attracted by this Islamic ideology.
And to what degree do we know whether Shabaab is linked to or trained by al-Qaeda?
It's very hard to get any detailed information because Somalia is a no-go zone. It's one of the most dangerous places in the world for anyone to operate, journalists, aid workers, diplomats, intelligence agents. So our information of Somalia is very pixelated. It's not like the information we have about Iraq or Afghanistan or these other war zones where there are tens of thousands of American troops. So what we know about the Shabaab is that it's a mix of these different elements, the Somali and the foreigners, and we think there are some links to al-Qaeda. We think that al-Qaeda may even be looking for a new haven because of the pressures in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they are thinking about moving operations and possibly some of their top people to Somalia because it's such a lawless part of the world, it's seen as ideal for terrorism. But in a way, it's too lawless for even al-Qaeda, and this has been talked about for years, ever since 2001, the September 11th attacks. People have worried that Somalia could become a new front for al-Qaeda, and it's never really developed, partly because it's so chaotic that nobody can be trusted, and that affects terrorism operations too.
But as I understand it, you have a fairly moderate Islamist president who came into office in February. What can the government do, if anything, about Shabaab?
Well, they need to launch a multi-pronged offensive against the Shabaab, both militarily, politically, socially, ideologically. And we're beginning to see the rumblings of that, but nothing has really materialized. On the military front, they're trying to build up a force of several thousand young Somalis, and they're currently in the pipeline being trained in the region in Uganda and Djibouti and other places, and the idea is in a couple months they'll bring them into Somalia to launch an offensive. But probably more important than that, the transitional government has to deliver some services that really matter to Somalis. They have to help build schools and build wells and pave roads and pick up garbage. And until they do that, they're going to look like just another weak, ineffective group of figures that nobody really knows much about and isn't delivering anything. And that's the problem, is the Shabaab have a concrete ideology, even though it's not really in sync with the Islam that's practiced in Somalia. They stand for something. And that's what we're waiting to see from the transitional government, is how will they respond? What type of program will they offer the Somali people?
Jeffrey Gettleman, he's New York Times East Africa Bureau Chief. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to help. Thank you.
Thank you. And turning to you, Rudy Atallah, what has the U.S. been doing to try and help the government of Somalia in the face of this growing danger that Jeffrey Gettleman described?
Well, I'm just going to backtrack just a little bit, just to kind of put it all in perspective. For some of the folks that are learning about Somalia for the first time, Somalia has been lawless since 1991. So it's since the ousting of Siad Barre in 1991, there hasn't been a cohesive government that's actually functioned. The international community has spent a lot of money, resources, trying to put Somalia back together and get a government in place. The last one being the transitional federal government, which was the 15th attempt by the international community to put Humpty Dumpty together. In 2004, a president was elected, Abdullahi Yusuf, who is from a clan from the northern part of Somalia, the Darod. And he was elected president, the prime minister was picked, the cabinet was put together. Unfortunately, when a Darod clansman comes over and takes power in the southern part where the clan is predominantly al-Hawiya, there was a lot of friction. Abdullahi Yusuf wasn't able to survive, and so we moved to the current president, which is Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmad. The problem with Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmad is he is not he's not loved by everyone, and he's not hated by everyone. And he's extremely weak and does not have the support that he needs from within his clan. The outside community has internationally, I'm talking about the U.S., I'm talking about countries like Norway, Sweden, various European countries, all try to help with limited resources, training of police, just to kind of give the TFG, the Transitional Federal Government, the backbone that it needs to survive in Mogadishu. The problem is it hasn't happened, and TFG remains extremely weak.
Rudy Atallah, he's a retired lieutenant colonel who worked in the Secretary of Defense Policy Office as the Africa Counterterrorism Director. Do join us, 800 833-885-0. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Robert Grenier, how strong is al-Shabaab? Do we know?
I think there's probably a great deal that we don't know. As Rudy was just pointing out, the political situation within Somalia is very confused. And in fact, al-Shabaab is not even the only radical Islamist organization that wields considerable power in Somalia. There's also the Hizbul Islam. And the leaders of both of those groups came out of a movement called the Islamic Courts Union, which for some time was able to impose at least some sort of coherent governance within Mogadishu itself. When the Ethiopians invaded Somalia in 2006, they were forced to flee, and that movement has since fractured, and that's why we see that some of the disunity that currently prevails in Somalia.
So what do the attacks in Mogadishu tell us about al-Shabaab and its relationship to al-Qaeda?
Well, al-Shabaab is the organization, as I just mentioned, there are two principal Islamist organizations. Al-Shabaab, for one reason or another, is the organization that has been able to attract a considerable number of foreign fighters. Nobody's really quite sure precisely how many, but it's through those foreign fighters that they have the links with al-Qaeda. And I think we're beginning to see their own tactics reflect al-Qaeda tactics elsewhere.
Robert Grenier, he's a consultant for the intelligence and security industry. He was CIA station chief in Pakistan until 2002. We'll take just a short break. We're back with your calls. And we're back to talk about the recent suicide bombings in Somalia and the links that may be apparent there between Shabaab, the group that's been accused but has not taken responsibility for those bombings. Here in the studio, Robert Grenier, he was director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center from 2005 to 2006, Rudy Atala. He's a retired lieutenant colonel who worked in the Secretary of Defense Policy Office as the Africa Counterterrorism Director, and Daniel Byman, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Dan, I'd like to ask you what we know about Shabaab, how strong its links could be to al-Qaeda in Somalia.
We don't know too much about a formal al-Qaeda presence in Somalia. We know that there has been some increased rhetorical interest from al-Qaeda Central with regard to Somalia, but in terms of the actual presence of al-Qaeda trainers and operatives seems quite limited. However, what we're seeing are some individuals who have had links to al-Qaeda in the past be present there. They have had ties to al-Shabaab. So there is a limited presence, but not a formal one. And this is an interesting contrast to places like Algeria or Saudi Arabia, where we've seen al-Qaeda establish a formal union or relationship with some local groups. But again, this is a common pattern with al-Qaeda, where after several years, it often tries to bring local groups on board its more global agenda.
And, of course, we heard from Jeffrey Gettleman that there may have been links to this group, Shabaab, in Somalia with a group here in the United States in Minnesota, Rudy Atala.
Yeah, in Minnesota, you have one of the largest Somali diasporas in the U.S. Over 70,000 Somalis live in the Minnesota area. And I would say in the last year, we had 20 Somalis recruited and who traveled back to Somalia. One being one young individual actually blew himself up in a suicide attack in northern Somalia. I mean, there's a pattern and trend going back to Al Qaeda's presence. And that's the main question we have here is, you have individuals who have who were associated or affiliated with the East Africa Al Qaeda cell that attacked our U.S. embassies in Nairobi. In Dar es Salaam in 1998, and they were also responsible for the Kikimbal attack in 2002 in Mombasa. These individuals have operated in and out of Somalia. Recently, one individual named Saleh Nabhan, who had al-Qaeda training, was providing training to al-Shabaab in the 17 different camps that they have in southern Somalia, teaching them how to build suicide vests, how to build VBIDs or car bombs. This individual was killed by forces that came out from the sea, special forces that removed Nabhan. That was a very good move because it takes away the strong operator within Shabaab that was giving them the training that they were looking for. 2008, there was a video that was made by this individual Nabhan and a guy named Mukhtar Robo, who was part of al-Shabaab. And in this video, they were making a plea to senior al-Qaeda members saying, look, we have all the camps, we have all the training set up here. Please send your jihadis over here to train with us. So there was a plea for big al-Qaeda to unify with them, but the handshake hasn't been made completely. And what we see is a group, Shabaab, trying to become a real strong al-Qaeda affiliates, but they still are in that struggle. Now, the other problem that they have is also internal clan dynamics play a big, big role in here where they're constantly fighting each other.
Bob Grenier.
Well, I think as we look at the terrorism problem globally, the primary concern revolves around areas where there is no effective or responsible political control, whether that's the border area in Afghanistan, Pakistan, whether that's the desert areas in southern Algeria, Yemen, and Somalia. And there's been concern within the U.S. government about the direction of Somalia from a counterterrorism point of view, at least since early 2005. And if anything, that concern has grown since.
I wanted to pick up on your point, Diane, about the individuals who came over from Minnesota. This is something that is of tremendous concern, of course, to local law enforcement and to the FBI. The good news is there seems to have been no indication that these individuals plan to come back to the United States to conduct attacks here. Mm-hmm. The bad news is, though, that this community is not a community that is well integrated into the American mainstream.
You were talking about the 70,000.
The 70,000 in Minnesota and more broadly the Somali American community, where, of course, like most immigrant communities, the vast majority are very appreciative of their life in the United States.
And peaceful.
And
very,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But the problem is that this community seems a bit more like some of the Muslim communities in Europe, in particular, the Pakistani community in the United Kingdom, where it is not closely integrated into the mainstream, and you see more concern about violence in the home country, and you see more dissatisfaction, more unemployment, more poverty, a whole host of problems that in general are not characteristic of the American Muslim community, but are present in the Somali American community.
So al-Qaeda stepping in where a void perhaps is created in terms of benefits in terms of support offers itself, or Shabab offers itself to al-Qaeda, hoping to create a more tangible link, Bob Grenier?
Well, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I think that what we're seeing with a number of groups, and al-Shabab is prominent among them, is that as they evolve, they are focused less on the national struggle, or not exclusively on the national struggle with it, with which they are involved, but begin to see themselves as part of a global movement. Mm. And as such, it becomes easier for them then to attract people, including in this case from the Somali diaspora, from far away, people who may be concerned with or have concerns about the plight of Muslims in many different parts of the world, perhaps to include their own communities, whose outlet for that then arises with groups like Shabab.
And, of course, last week, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said that a string of recent arrests mm-hmm. should remove any remaining comfort that some might have had from the notion that if we fight the terrorists abroad, we won't have to fight them here. Tell me about that. What is she referring to when she talks about recent arrests and what's happening in this country?
Basically, when we had the first 20 Somali Americans go overseas and get involved with Shabab, it kicked off a series of investigations by the FBI. This investigation has grown and grown into recent arrests of Somalis that were involved, money laundering, movement of people, recruiting. That's exactly what she was referring to. As we're doing our homework now, and we're trying to see how big the network is, how extensive it is.
Bob Grenier.
Well, I think what Secretary Napolitano is reacting to now is a certain complacency that we've had within the United States. For some time now, we've seen the problem of radicalism within the Pakistani community in the UK, within the North African communities in France and Belgium. And they have much greater social difficulties there. Those communities are far less integrated into those societies than is the case for Muslims, generally speaking, within the United States. That said, however, and what she's referring to is a larger problem that we're beginning to see in the United States. I suspect that she was referring, for instance, to the recent arrest of Najib al-Azazi, mm-hmm. who is an Afghan American, not a citizen, but a U.S. person, someone who had residency here in the United States, who was radicalized, went back to Pakistan, received training and support, and was at the heart of a rather mature terrorist plot here within the United States. There were two other individuals, Pakistani Americans, one of whom was a fellow by the name of Headley. They were arrested here in the United States. Their plot was not to attack targets here in the United States, but actually in Denmark. So what we're seeing is at least the beginning of perhaps a broader phenomenon that's of great concern here in the United
Daniel
States.
Daniel Byman.
The Najib al-Azazi case is of particular concern to many in the counterterrorism community. If you look at the arrests that the FBI has done since September 11th, the people in the United States arrested, while a number of them up to quite nasty things, have almost invariably been low-skilled, and the plots have barely gotten off the ground. Azazi seems the opposite in both cases. His plot was relatively advanced. A number of leaks so far, media reports have said that it looks like he was quite close and it took a few lucky breaks. But also, I think most important, he is someone linked to the al-Qaeda core in Pakistan. And the various attackers and plotters before that didn't have those links, and that made him far less mm-hmm. dangerous. But in Zazi, we're all very concerned that this is the beginning of a future set of links to the al-Qaeda core.
You know, it's interesting, Rudy. It would seem that prisons themselves, once people are arrested, can become breeding grounds for these radicals.
Absolutely. We see it quite a bit in North Africa. I'd use Morocco as an example, where young people are arrested for whatever crime. Then they're taking in the now they're a captive audience for someone who can radicalize them in the prisons, and once released, a lack of program to reintegrate them into society properly makes these young people go and gravitate to the extremist groups, and then from there, go on to bad things. So what we need to do is actually boost up our programs and working with the prisons in some of these countries to try to help them to de-radicalize young people and also separate the extremists from the rest of the crowd so there's no recruiting.
Daniel Byman.
Prisons are, some people have called them the universities for terrorism. And this is a mistake that country after country seems to make, which is that once you've arrested and tried and imprisoned the bad people, that they've gone away. But actually the opposite seems to be true. In Northern Ireland, in Israel, we saw prisons become breeding grounds for terrorists where they became far more capable after they came out of prison than before they went in.
What about in this country? Is that same radicalization going on?
Absolutely. You see it in different ways. I mean, in some cases, it's individuals who were committed of minor crimes joining a criminal gang. So, of course, the various gangs recruit in prisons, but increasingly you see it for terrorist groups as well.
Daniel Byman, he directs Georgetown University's Center for Peace and Security Studies, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, John, in Cincinnati, Ohio. You're on the air.
Yes, Diane. You know, my family up in Maine, Lewiston, Maine, I have a lot of relatives up there. They brought about 1,000 Somalis up there, put them in apartments, and, you know, put them on a dole. They charities, bring them over, you know, on planes and everything, and put them on a dole here. And then that could be like they're living better than they're living in their own country, even on the dole here. And they're still better people. Because, you know, I got relatives up there, and they talk about them, that they don't want to work even, because they're doing better than they did over in their own country.
Thanks for calling, John.
John, that's a great point. Somalis do, many of them are very appreciative, and the bulk of them don't have, any problems or issues or have gravitated to extremist groups. The big problem is with the youth. You know, youth always are looking for as we say in French, raison d'être, a reason to be. And in the case of the 20 that were actually recruited and sent overseas, they weren't fitting in with the American society. They weren't fitting in with kids their own age. They were looking for a reason to be. And so they were recruited after the invasion of Somalia by Ethiopia, and they found out that they looked at it as, you know, a reason to fight for something that they believe in, and that is to remove Ethiopia from Somalia. So,
Bob Grenier.
One of the things that we have to focus on, I think, very consciously in this country is as we become more seized with the potential threat in some of our Muslim communities in this country, we have to be very careful lest we paint those communities with a broad brush. Somalis have come to the United States for the same reasons that immigrants have come from all over the world. And the most dangerous thing that we could do would be in unfairly focusing on those communities, unfairly targeting them for harassment. We would make it less likely that those communities are able then to police themselves and to cooperate with authorities in a way that the vast majority of them, I think, otherwise would very much want to.
But people listening to this program are going to say to themselves, how do I know? How do I know that these Somalis who are coming into New Hampshire or Boston or Minnesota aren't here to create problems? How can I be sure that the U.S. government has made sure that these are peaceful people coming into this country, Dan?
The U.S. government has tried hard to stay on top of possible problems coming out of the Somali American community. But to add to that further, one of the big dangers is that if the community leaders themselves don't feel they can trust authorities, then you lose your best sense of information. This is often a very tight community. Individuals know one another quite well. And if you're able to tap into responsible leaders there, you know what's going on. And actually, that's the best defense against radicalism. What becomes a much greater concern is if the community leaders see the police as hostile, and as a result, they're not willing to work with them, then you have quite a serious danger of radicalization that the FBI and others are not on top of.
Daniel Byman of Georgetown University. Robert Grenier, he was director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center from 2005 to 2006. Rudy Atala, he's a retired lieutenant colonel. He worked in the Secretary of Defense Policy Office as the Africa Counterterrorism Director. Short break, more of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities takes aim at the culture wars. Former Republican Congressman Jim Leach on why he's launching a 50-state civility tour and trying to bridge cultures within America. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And before we continue our conversation on what's happening in Somalia, the rise of terrorist influence, I'd like to welcome our new listeners from Aspen Public Radio. Joining us for the first time today, we're delighted that you're joining the Diane Rehm Show and look forward to hearing your questions and comments. I want to take a call in York, Maine. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to state that not all experiences with the Somali community in the state of Maine were as John portrayed. The Lewiston community is largely Franco-American and closed to pretty much anyone who's not from Canada at one point in time. Whereas the Somali experience in Greater Portland has been quite different. They have cultural centers, halal markets, and seem to be not only self-sustaining, but pretty well integrated into city fabric.
Any comments, Rudy?
No, George is absolutely spot on. I mean, Somali communities, generally, there are no issues, and Somalis are extremely resourceful people. They're excellent business people, And they do take care of their communities very, very well. I mean, in every community, including ours here in the States, we have our own issues and problems. And especially when we talk about youth. So we shouldn't be labeling them anything except for they're here to look for the American dream, and they do exceptionally well.
I want to broaden this from simply Somalia to the issue of the relationship between al-Qaeda and the Taliban and how Shabaab could fit into that. Bob Grenier.
Well, what we've seen in Pakistan, Afghanistan, is that over time, as greater pressure has been put on the Taliban, both the Afghan Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, other extremist groups in that area, it has caused them to change the way they think about themselves. They think about themselves increasingly as part of a global movement, and it has forced these groups to cooperate more closely with one another and with al-Qaeda. And the concern that I and others would have in the case of Somalia is that a similar dynamic could take hold there, where al-Shabaab, in order to assert its power, is going to look for support wherever it can find it. And given their ideological orientation, al-Qaeda is a very logical partner for them. But again, that is part, as we've just been saying, of a global phenomenon.
Dan.
Somalia would prove, I think, a very tough place for al-Qaeda to go in with large numbers. The divisions, not only within Somalia in general, but even within the Shabaab, are going to make it hard for al-Qaeda to form a close alliance with the organization. Even worse is the remarkable state of chaos and violence in the country means that the organization risks being, in a way, literally held hostage, because it can be seen as a cash cow by a number of rival Somali groups that will try to extort money. This happened to the organization in the early 1990s when it tried to set up shop in the Horn of Africa. And a couple years later, they effectively beat a retreat from parts of the area because they simply found it too chaotic for them to function.
We've had a caller, Abdul, from Saudi Arabia, who says that these problems in the Muslim world are due to poverty and political and economic injustice. How do you react to that, Dan?
I think there's certainly some truth to that. The Muslim world, it's hard to speak coherently about such a huge number of people, but there are a fair number of countries in the Muslim world that have a mix of very nasty problems, ranging from endemic corruption to a lack of economic opportunities, and in particular to governments that are dysfunctional and illegitimate in a number of ways. And this is a real problem because let's put yourself in the position of an 18-year-old Egyptian who wants a good job, who wants to participate in government. You often have very few options, and the vast majority of those don't turn to violence. But I think many Americans find it somewhat intuitive that someone with no opportunities is more likely to turn to violence to change the system than someone who has peaceful opportunities to do so.
All right. I'll take a caller here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Mohammed. Go right ahead, please.
Good morning, Diane, and you and your guests. Thank you for the interest about Somalia. My condolences to the fallen heroes of Somalia, Sudan, and Terrorist Act. I'm the chairman of the Somali American Peace Council, four times to the White House, to the president specifically, to meet him, and we did not get a response. The only response we got was one that all the citizens would like to meet him. Sorry, we have no time. And three times to Secretary Hillary Clinton. The best answer I got, at least, we get from the House, October 27 letter, where they were saying, we need your expertise, we want to meet you. And as of today, we could not have.
All right, sir. And your comment.
My two questions. Number one, why our U.S. government, especially the current administration, does not have a comprehensive foreign policy for Somalia? And number two, why the U.S. government is not consulting the Somali Americans about the Somali?
All right. Thanks for your call. How much of a comprehensive program does the U.S. have for Somalia, Rudy?
Well, like I said earlier in the show, the U.S. has been trying for a very long time to work on Somalia. And having said that, it's a challenge because trying to understand the complexities of Somalia is not easy. The previous administration worked very closely with Somalis to try to get the TFG up and running. A lot of investments were put into the transitional federal government after it came into power in 2004. We continue to work with the current TFG. And there's a lot of consulting going on with Somalis. The difference is when you work with one group of Somalis, another group of Somalis may not be in agreement. Mm-hmm. So you have these dynamics that take place all the time, and that's the challenge.
Bob Grenier.
Well, as Rudy's pointing out, it's very difficult to find a bolt hole, to find an opportunity that you can then seize. There's been a great reluctance, and I think understandably and wisely so, to try to side with one faction, particularly a clan or tribally based, against others. And so we've been trying to look for some sort of a viable center, and that has been represented at least by the TFG. TFG has simply not been able to gain any traction, at least in a sustained way, among the chaos of internal politics in Somalia.
Thanks for calling. Let's go to Durham, North Carolina. Hi there, Jay. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. My question is, what chance do we have of using this phenomenon to our advantage? And if there are dangerous Americans who are trusted by Al-Qaeda, what chance do we have of, turning somebody and getting information? And it seems like that's our greatest strength, is the diversity of our communities.
Bob Grenier.
Well, as a former CIA operative, I suspect that that idea has probably occurred to some within the CIA and elsewhere in the intelligence community. And I'm out of that game. I certainly have no knowledge of what's happening inside, but I do hope.
What tactics could be used?
Well, absolutely. I think that as you see the internationalization of these organizations, as you see people traveling as they do across borders, that also provides operational opportunities which are being seized upon by the Americans and by others.
Rudy, any thoughts?
I agree completely with what you said. I also say we work with we work very closely with our European colleagues to monitor some of these communities and then try to pinpoint those who are laundering money, trying to radicalize young individuals, and from there we just step up our programs and try to take action, and we've done that successfully.
I'd be interested in the so-called infamous 100. Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan. What do we know about them, Bob?
Well, the number 100 is an intelligence judgment. I don't think it's based on a firm count. The phenomenon that I think people are trying to get their arms around here is what sort of influence, what sort of impact does Al-Qaeda, at least as narrowly defined, actually have in its dealings with the Afghan Taliban and other extremist groups? While it's difficult to understand precisely how it works from the inside, precisely what numbers of Al-Qaeda extremists are actually lodged there along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, the results of their presence are very easy to discern. We've seen terrorist tactics that have been perfected in Iraq and that have now migrated to that area. Just a very few years ago, suicide attacks were simply unknown in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. They're now rife in that area. Technology for improvised explosive devices has now become very sophisticated. Again, that knowledge has been migrated through Al-Qaeda as a means of transmission from the Iraqi sphere into Afghanistan and Pakistan. Al-Qaeda clearly has a very important influence there. How many operatives are on one side of the border or the other on a given day, nobody really knows, and frankly, it doesn't really matter very much.
All right, to Columbus, Ohio. Good morning, Ali. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I appreciate your show. First, I have a quick comment, then a question. I'm a Somali American, Somali Americans in Columbus, Ohio, are so devastated and very sorry the tragic news of the kids being brainwashed and then sent back home to fight. And my question is, why the people who recruits the kids here in U.S., in the mosques, and taken away from their parents and then sending them back, supporting for their financial and everything, and being not being accountable or persecuted, and again to get the justice they deserve? That is the question. Another question is, Al-Shabaab is supporting the most sovereign of Somalia, and the government is a very weak and powerless. Is there any way a U.S. or European allies could support this weak Somali government to get rid of Al-Shabaab?
Rudy.
Well, just to reverse it there, Ali, we have been supporting the TFG. The problem is it's very weak and it takes time. We've been training police. We've trained police outside of the Somali borders to bring them back. You know, as you well know, and you're very well aware, we just got to also make sure that the numbers are right in terms of the different clans and subclans, so we're not upsetting anybody. But Sheikh Sharif, I said earlier, is not loved by most and is not hated by most. So he's kind of in the middle. He doesn't have a very large support group. In terms of combating Shabab, you have Hezbollah Islam that's fighting Shabab. You have Ahl Sunnah that's fighting Al-Shabaab. You have, you know, and the dynamics in there are very complex. You know, Hezbollah Islam is a purist. They're all Somalis. So is Ahl Sunnah. The Shabab is the only one that's bringing in foreigners into the country. And so it becomes complex, and we're trying to work in the middle of all this complex dynamics, but it's not easy.
Bob Grenier.
Well, looking at the other half of that question, having to do with radicalization within the United States, this is something that the FBI is very much seized with. The FBI's efforts to try to understand the nature of these problems within our society is, frankly, a relatively new function for them. In the past, the FBI has reacted to crimes once they are committed. Now they have to get out in front and understand these problems before they actually arise or actually manifest themselves. And at the end of the day, it's Somali communities that are going to have to police themselves.
Robert Grenier, he's chair of ERG Partners, a consultant for the intelligence and security industry. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Want to go back to the phones and to Shamar Kay in Williamsburg, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, there's a part of Somalia, the northwestern part, which is very stable and has a central government. Can we use them as a tool to make a peace between the fighting groups in the southern Somalia, since they have had their own Somali homegrown system that's working for them?
Rudy.
Yeah, that's an outstanding point, actually, and that's something that we've tried to work on for a long time, and you're referencing Somaliland. Somaliland has done a very good job of having their free and fair elections. And as you well know, in southern Somalia, Shabab is very opposed to Somaliland's independence. We talking in the U.S. government, have looked at Somaliland and trying to work closely with it and trying to boost it up. That part of Somalia that's a lot more stable would probably become an oasis for folks in the south to look at and say, well, if they can get it together, then we should be doing the same thing. And that's the direction I think that this U.S. government is taking. It just it takes time to make it happen.
Are we likely in the coming days, months, years to see more activity of the type we saw recently with suicide bombings in Somalia? Rudy.
I'll start off by saying this is not the first time a suicide bomber has attacked in Somalia. The first one was actually when the former TFG government was in power in Baidoa. The first attack happened in September 2006, and then we've had multiple suicide attacks since. The TFG has been targeted since the beginning. So this is not a surprise. I think this will continue as long as Shabab is around. The thing is, I think it'll remain clustered inside of Somalia, mainly southern Somalia, because it's a struggle for Shabab to gain control. Once and if Shabab takes control of southern Somalia, I think they're going to have some serious issues because they're internally divided as well. So, which is a benefit for us because they'll turn against each other.
Dan Byman.
Suicide bombing, in my judgment, is likely to grow and perhaps even spread in Somalia, where we've seen this tactic introduced in the past. Other groups have often emulated it, in part because it's very effective. If you look at the recent bombing, for example, the individual was able to get quite close to time it. It's much harder to do that if you simply plant a bomb and leave. And unfortunately, there seems to be a ready supply of young men willing to kill themselves. So from a group's point of view, this is cost effective.
Daniel Byman of Georgetown University. Robert Grenier, he was director of CIA's Counterterrorism Center from 2005 to 2006. And Rudy Atala, he is the founder of the security consulting firm White Mountain Research. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.